everyone. I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And you're listening to Key to the Case. We want to give a big thank you to all of our listeners and supporters, and also thank you to those of you who have reached out to us directly. We always appreciate that, and we love to hear from you. So, Sean, are you ready to dive into today's case?
Yes, I am. Let's do it.
Allie Aisha Grimsley Gilmore was born on January 5th, 1976, in Riviera Beach, Florida. Sadly, Allie's father was not in the picture, and she spent the first 11 years of her life living with her mother's niece because her mother was having an unknown set of issues going on in her life. I don't know the exact age difference between Allie's mother and her sibling's daughter who took care of Allie, but I suspect the sibling was quite a bit older than Allie's mother if the niece was old enough to take care of Allie and be Allie's guardian. According to the Tallahassee Democrat, Allie did learn who her father was when she was 9 years old, but they didn't get to meet or begin a relationship because he died just a couple of months before she learned of his identity. Once Allie's mother was able, she took Allie back in when she was 11 years old, and she and her husband, so Allie's stepfather, ran a no-nonsense household. One of her rules was that when each of her children turned 18, they had to register to vote. I like that. I mean, it's not really a no-nonsense rule, but it's probably one of the last rules she was able to implement because they were 18 at that point. They were adults. Allie had sisters who she had a tight bond with, and according to Never Seen Again from Paramount Plus, Allie's younger sister viewed her as a role model, and she often followed in Allie's footsteps. Allie was a naturally gifted runner, so when she got to high school, she quickly became known as a track star, breaking a number of records. But Allie excelled academically as well, and she maintained a part-time job at a Publix grocery store. One descriptor commonly used when people discuss Allie is hardworking, and that will be evident as we carry on in this story, if it wasn't already. Allie is also described as friendly, giving, talented, and smart. After Allie graduated high school a year early in 1993, she attended Florida A&M University in Tallahassee, which is a little over 400 miles away or over 600 kilometers away from where she grew up in Riviera Beach. Initially, like many people, Allie wasn't 100% sure what she wanted to major in. She contemplated going into pharmacy, but she ultimately got her bachelor's degree in health information management. After she graduated and obtained her degree, she landed a job in the Florida Department of Health in the Evaluation and Planning Data Analysis Department. This role makes a lot of sense based on her degree, and this is the first victim we've discussed who I can actually relate to their job. I am a data analyst for a health plan, and our population is primarily Medicaid members. So Allie and I probably would have kind of spoken the same language when it comes to work, at least to some extent. Although Allie had a full-time job, she maintained a part-time position at a Publix in Tallahassee, where she worked nights and weekends in the bakery to earn additional income. I have to hand it to her. She truly was a hardworking woman. I can't imagine finishing up my full-time workday, and then going to an entirely different job.
Yeah, geez, how did she even find time to sleep? That's such a busy schedule.
I know, it seems super tiring. And I was thinking about it, and I'm like, well, okay, I guess I have a full-time job, and I do all of the research for this podcast, and that takes a lot of time, but it's so different because I get to pick when I work on it, and I can stop at any point. When she's going to Publix after her full-time job, she can't just leave whenever she wants. She has an assigned shift.
Yeah, you're... Thank you for doing all the research, by the way, but you are picking your own schedule when to do it, and she unfortunately is not. So good for her for having such a strong work ethic.
Right. Allie was a driven woman. That was apparent. About a year after Allie graduated from college, she met a man named James Gilmore at a local mall. James told Never Seen Again that he was working at a kiosk that sold picture frames, and Allie needed her diploma framed, so he helped her with the request. The two hit it off, and he asked for her phone number, at which point they began dating. After dating for about 8 months, James proposed to Allie at the same mall they met in, and James described that Allie was elated. James had been married in the past and had three children. And by all accounts, Allie had a great relationship with his children and thought of them as her own. The pair officially got married in 2000 in downtown Tallahassee, and they kicked off their marriage by celebrating at Disney World for their honeymoon. It wasn't too long before they purchased a home together in Tallahassee, which Allie was incredibly excited about and proud of. It's an exciting time, you know, buying your first home. Eventually, the discussion of children came up between Allie and James. It appeared that because James already had children, he left the decision up to Allie. They decided that if they were to have children, they wouldn't have a large number of children. The summer prior to Allie's disappearance, she learned the exciting news that she was pregnant, and Allie was a planner. So she started planning for the baby's arrival right away. But sadly, Allie suffered a miscarriage just a couple of months after learning she was pregnant, and she was crushed. Shortly after learning the news, Allie and James began to have marital issues. At that point, James had returned to school full-time and relied on Allie's income to get by financially. This created a stressful situation for both of them, and according to James, they fought often and didn't communicate well. In October 2005, their problems came to a head, and James made the decision to move out of their shared home and to move in with his brother. This would be just about 5 months before Allie's disappearance.
So they're still married at this point? Or are they separated?
They're still married. I guess you could consider them separated, but they hadn't gotten divorced or anything yet. According to the Tallahassee Democrat, Allie's coworkers were also aware of Allie's financial stress, and she vented about how she was ready to have one place of employment, and who can blame her? Her situation sounded exhausting to me. Not long after Allie separated from James, she attended Florida A&M University's homecoming celebration in the fall of 2005. It would be at this very event where she met a man named Dwight Aldridge. Dwight and Allie spent the homecoming celebration together and subsequently began dating in the months following that event. According to Never Seen Again, Dwight was someone who had a lot of girlfriends. It doesn't sound like he was known to be a monogamist. I'll put it that way. For the second time, Allie learned the exciting news that she was pregnant, and Allie confided in her sister that she wanted to make it work with James. She said that she truly loved him and that he was the father of her child. She even considered giving the baby the same initials as James. So just a couple of months after he moved out, Allie and James began an attempt to reconcile their relationship, and Allie shared the news that she was pregnant. Part of this rekindling involved going to couples counseling, and this was something they both thought would be valuable to their relationship.
So she knows the father of this child is James's and not the new boyfriend's?
We'll get into that because it is a question. This brings us to Thursday, February 2nd, 2006, a day that brought a large thunderstorm producing nickel-sized hail and tornado watches. This Thursday started out as any ordinary Thursday would. Allie went to work at the Department of Health, and on this day in particular, she was a little bit stressed. She had just learned that the taxes on her house had increased dramatically, and she was concerned about how she would be able to afford this mostly unexpected cost. Allie's coworker tried to calm her down and help her think through a resolution. Allie left work at 5 p.m. and headed to her job at Publix. While at Publix, she spoke with James on the phone around 8:45 p.m. to remind him of a counseling session they had scheduled for the following day at 9 a.m. Allie left Publix sometime between 11 p.m. and midnight and went home. The following day, Allie didn't report to work, which initially was expected. Her coworkers knew that she had the counseling session in the morning, and they anticipated her absence for the first few hours of the day. But her supervisor was out sick that day. So when her coworkers noticed that Allie didn't appear at all, they figured the counseling session didn't go well and she took the rest of the day off. Which, as her coworkers, they're not really responsible for monitoring Allie's absence, in my opinion. For all they knew, she could have called her supervisor who was sick at home and informed her that she wouldn't be in. Later, it was determined that Allie didn't make it to the counseling session, but neither did James. James said he overslept that morning and woke up around 11 a.m. And as soon as he realized that he'd missed the appointment, he called Allie's job, where he assumed she was, and left a voicemail to apologize. James tried to reach Allie again the following day on Saturday, but when she didn't pick up his phone calls, he headed over to her house. Allie didn't answer the door when he knocked, but because her car was parked in the driveway, he assumed that Allie was really mad at him and was simply ignoring him. Monday, February 6th rolled around, and when Allie didn't show for work again, her supervisor and coworkers felt concerned. So concerned that they went to Allie's house to check on her. They found Allie's home in the same condition as James did. Her car was in the driveway, her porch light was on, and her bedroom light appeared to be on as well. After they discovered that Allie's home appeared that she should be home, but she wasn't, they called the police and reported Allie as a missing person. The Tallahassee Police Department contacted James and asked if he knew where she was. He explained that he assumed she was at home, but when they let him know that she was not at home and she had been reported missing, he immediately contacted Allie's family to share the news. They were in disbelief that she could be missing, as I'm sure most people would in that situation. When police scoured Allie's home, they found no signs of foul play, no blood, it didn't appear anything was stolen, and there were no signs that a struggle took place. Allie's work uniform was found in her bedroom, which confirmed that she made it home that night. Her bed was unmade with the covers pulled back slightly, and there was a prenatal book sitting on the bed. So it appeared that she got home, changed, possibly showered, got in bed, and did a little bit of reading. But what happened next? Both Allie's car and front door were locked, indicating that she most likely left on foot or someone picked her up. The only item noted as missing from Allie's home were her house keys. Her purse, wallet, and ID were all accounted for inside her car, so it didn't appear that wherever she went, she intended to be gone for long. Because the day she was last seen was a rainy, stormy one, and she would have arrived home late at night, the likelihood of Allie choosing to leave her home on foot seems fairly low. If someone picked Allie up, that person has not come forward, and you have to wonder why.
Whoever wanted to meet up with her, it probably had to be pretty important since she got home at what, 11:30, 12, and she leaves her house again to go meet up with someone, and she has a early morning meeting the next morning. So to me, it would seem to have to be pretty important, because if I got home at midnight and I had an early morning meeting, I would want to get some sleep for that.
I agree. It seems like whatever this was, whatever pulled her out of her house that night, had to be pretty urgent, or at least the way the person presented the issue or the reason for wanting to see her, they presented it in a way that made Allie think, okay, I have to go now.
Unless this meeting was planned beforehand, I would want to see if anyone called her, if she called anyone.
Yes, there was one phone call that Allie received, which we'll get into a little bit more later, because for the longest time, it was reported that this phone call was received at 12:48 a.m., and that's all that was reported. But we learn a little bit more in more recent news, which I'll share later on.
My initial opinion is it was either James or Dwight who made the call.
Right. They make sense. I wouldn't necessarily think a friend of Allie's would be calling her to hang out or meet up at that hour, especially on a weeknight. But we don't necessarily know what was standard for Allie and her friends. Allie's family sprung into action and worked to spread the word of her disappearance. They created missing person flyers that they distributed widely. They participated in interviews with local news stations, and they were involved in a number of different searches that were conducted to try to find Allie. There was a massive search by air and foot in the area surrounding Allie's home, as well as the nearby Apalachicola National Forest. Searchers were looking for any item that could have possibly been tossed out of a vehicle, as well as items that could have human cadaver or human scent on it. Not a single trace of Allie was found through these searches, and to this day, there's never been a trace of her. Allie's disappearance made national news, and her story was featured on shows like Nancy Grace, Dateline, and the Montel Williams Show.
So were they able to find any evidence outside the home? Like you said, it was pretty rainy during that day prior to when she went missing. So I was kind of wondering if they found any footprints in the mud or tire marks from another car or, you know, really anything, any outside evidence that they could try to attribute to her disappearance?
From what I could find, no, I didn't see it reported that there was any evidence outside of her home or inside her home either. So unfortunately, there was nothing to work with in that regard. One of the first people to be put under the investigative spotlight was Allie's husband, James. On the surface, he seems like a good person to start with. He's Allie's spouse. They had conflict in their relationship. He didn't report Allie missing. He didn't show up for the counseling session. It doesn't look great for him.
So were Allie and Dwight still kind of seeing each other at this point?
I believe they were. I'll be honest, it was a little unclear what exactly their relationship was, and we can talk about that more, but I believe they were still both in the picture for the other.
Okay, so did James know about her relationship with Dwight?
Yes. During their separation, Allie did make James aware of this relationship she had with Dwight, and I think he was a little taken aback by it because he said that he hadn't been seeing anyone else, so he was just a little surprised.
Since James was surprised learning the fact that she was seeing another guy, they must not have discussed, you know, any sort of ground rule. I guess not ground rules, but discussed seeing other people during their separation, right?
Yeah, that's the impression I got. Almost like they just didn't talk about it. And because why else would he be surprised if they had? James told Never Seen Again that he made call after call to apologize for missing the counseling session, but after she repeatedly didn't answer, he truly thought she was infuriated with him and avoiding him. I have to say, the whole story is believable to me. Like, I can see this all playing out exactly how he said it played out. It makes sense to me that he would think she's so mad at him for missing this appointment because he knew how important it was to her. I don't think most people's first thought in this situation is, oh, something terrible has happened. Now, if they had the counseling appointment and it went really well and she wasn't responding after that, then that would be a different story, a totally different context, and probably cause for concern.
So what did the police think about James after questioning him? Because to me, based on the information you've provided, it seems like James just wants to fix the relationship. And when Allie's not answering the phone, James isn't thinking, oh my God, she's gone. She's disappeared. It seems like he's thinking, wow, she's mad at me.
Yes, that's exactly what it appears. And that weekend leading up to when she was reported missing, I think that's what was going through his head. In the period after Allie's disappearance, James participated in a voice stress test that reportedly provided results that were satisfactory to the investigation, and he cooperated wholly with the investigation. James also had an alibi through his brother, who he lived with, so his time was accounted for during the period Allie was believed to disappear. The lead investigator in this case, Lieutenant Jeff Mahoney, does not believe James was involved in Allie's disappearance. So it kind of seemed like there was a puzzle coming together, right, with James, but it just completely crumbles when you look at this case a little bit closer. And in the interview James did with Never Seen Again, I found him to be credible. He seemed totally honest and just kind of like a normal, nice guy. Not like I'm an expert on body language or anything, but he seemed to be truthful. And maybe some of that feeling comes from a little bit of hindsight in what I'm about to share with you. Like I mentioned earlier, it was established early on in the investigation that Allie received a phone call at 12:48 a.m. And if you recall, she left work sometime between 11 and 12, so she likely had been home for about an hour or two when she received the call. It took 15 years, but police finally publicly revealed that the phone call was from Dwight Aldridge. This phone call is so pivotal. The person who last spoke to someone before they disappear, in any case, is going to be pivotal to that investigation. And there was no one else known to have spoken with Allie that night after that point. When investigators spoke with Dwight, he admitted that he talked with Allie on the phone that night, but he dismissed the notion that they may have seen each other. Another clue presented itself when investigators came upon a calendar in Allie's home. In this calendar, they found Allie's date of conception circled from back in October with the initials DA. Dwight Aldridge. When I was researching, like we talked about, it was a little unclear to me if James was the father of Allie's baby or if Dwight was, just because the timing of their relationships kind of overlapping. But learning this detail cleared it all up for me. And it was also reported that Dwight attended a couple of doctor's appointments with Allie. So Dwight was fully aware that this baby was on the way.
Okay, so the baby has been confirmed as Dwight's. So at the same time, James and Allie are in the process of rebuilding the relationship. So if James found this out that they're trying to rebuild their family and their marriage, and he finds out that Allie's pregnant with another man's baby, to me, it would seem like that would be motive.
It does appear that way. But the thing is, I don't think James knew that Dwight was the father of the baby Allie was expecting. My understanding is he was aware that there were paternity issues, but I don't know that he knew for a fact that Dwight was the father of the baby.
Okay, so he may have thought that he was the father.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, and so that phone call from Dwight at 1 a.m., 12:45 a.m., whatever it was, that the night that Allie disappeared is very suspicious.
Super suspicious. And Dwight claimed he and Allie had discussed potentially getting an abortion. I believe they discussed this on the night of her disappearance during that phone call they had. That part is a little unclear, but I find this incredibly hard to believe. Everything I found in my research indicated that Allie would not want an abortion. She was excited for the baby. She was planning like crazy. She was 4.5 months pregnant, so she still had a good amount of time left in her pregnancy, but she was always thinking ahead. And she had the prenatal book sitting on her bed the night she disappeared. Is it possible that she changed her mind? Yes, but I couldn't find a shred of information that supported the idea that Allie wanted an abortion or had even considered it.
So regardless of the father, she was moving forward with having this baby.
Yes.
And no one could sway her either way.
Right. That's how it seemed. Allie was excited to have this baby, looking forward to it. She was telling everyone about it. There was nothing that indicated that she would even entertain the idea of an abortion. It could be true that Dwight wanted an abortion and Allie didn't. Now, if that were the case, that could be the motive to harm Allie. I'm not saying it was, but it could be. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with the fact that one of the leading causes of death for pregnant women is homicide. Compare that to non-pregnant women who are of childbearing age. The leading causes of death are breast cancer, road injuries, and cervical cancer, according to a study conducted by the National Institutes of Health. It's so chilling to me. If I had never heard that, I would not assume that homicide is a leading cause of death for pregnant women at all. We don't know that Allie is dead. We don't have proof of that. I hope that's not the case, but at this point, she's missing person, but it's hard not to consider this information when discussing the disappearance of a pregnant woman.
It doesn't seem like she would get up and walk away just with her keys on her. It definitely seems like someone else had a hand in her disappearance.
No, and if she wanted to go start another life, you'd think you would bring a few more items with you besides your house keys. Actually, the house keys are one of the least likely items I'd think you would bring if you were leaving your life, because you wouldn't be going back to your house. The house keys being gone seemed to indicate that Allie intended to return home in a short period. And she would presumably still want to give birth to this baby. Well, she'd have to give birth to the baby somewhere. You'd think there'd be some record of that.
Yeah. I mean, at minimum, she'd bring her car and her wallet.
Something. How did she even get away? So clearly someone would have had to have helped if she wanted to do that. I don't think there's any possibility that Allie just left her life. Dwight claimed to have an alibi the night of Allie's disappearance. He said he was at his home located along Ocala Road in Tallahassee. I don't have the exact location of Dwight's house, but a fair approximation would be 5 to 7 miles or roughly 8 to 11 kilometers away from Allie's house. He claimed that later that night, he drove to Bristol, Florida to his girlfriend's house, which is nearly 50 miles or 80 kilometers away from Allie's home in Tallahassee. But when investigators conducted a review of Dwight's phone records, they uncovered that Dwight's phone was pinging off the cell tower nearest to Allie's neighborhood during the phone call he had with Allie.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Lying to the police is a quick way to ensure that their focus will shift to you. And that's effectively what happened here. Dwight's home and car were searched, but no evidence was uncovered. Dwight was cooperative early on in the investigation, but once his lies regarding his whereabouts on the nights of Allie's disappearance came out, he refused to cooperate any further. Dwight has only made one statement to the public, from what I could find, and that was to the Tallahassee Democrat in July 2009, in which he categorized the relationship as just a friendship. And I guess what I'd say about that is most people don't have babies with their friends. I suppose he could have meant after they conceived the baby, they just had a friendship. His interview wasn't much of an interview because he said he couldn't get into the details of what he spoke with the police about and that he didn't recall the last time he spoke with Allie or what her state of mind was because it had been so long. This interview was about 3.5 years after she went missing. And what I find strange is that if someone in my life went missing, especially someone I was, I don't know, expecting a child with, I'd probably remember the last conversation I had with them, or at the very least, what their general state of mind was at that time. Those closest to Allie have indicated that Allie and Dwight had more than a friendship, and Allie told them they were dating. One email from Allie to her sister from December 2005 reads, quote, "Dwight and I still talk 2 or 3 times a day. We see each other 3 times a week. He said, I changed since I'm pregnant. My past miscarriage haunts me every few days. Then on top of all of that, the paternity issues." End quote. So I don't know if it's the case that Allie and Dwight define the relationship differently or if Dwight was downplaying the relationship intentionally.
Yeah, there are 3 different aspects of Dwight's story that are pretty damning. The first being he blatantly lied about his location. He was in very close proximity to Allie's house the night she disappeared. The second is obviously the phone call at whatever it was, 1 a.m., 12:45 a.m., the night she disappeared. And then the third is the discussion of abortion, which Allie evidently did not want to go through with. But if there was a discussion, I'm kind of assuming it was initiated by Dwight, since Allie seemed she was all for, you know, seeing the pregnancy through. So those 3 pieces of the story are pointing me in Dwight's direction. And I think it's pretty damning. Whatever word you want to use, but it
doesn't look good for him. And I think all of those reasons, and even more probably that we don't know, are why police consider Dwight a potential suspect in Allie's disappearance. That's how they're viewing him. And regarding the abortion, really quickly, I won't pretend to get into Allie's head and know what she was thinking. The point I'm trying to make is that there was nothing to point in the direction that she was considering this. And she even made comments about how she was trying to be extra careful during this pregnancy because her past miscarriage, which makes me sad because the miscarriage was not her fault, but that again points me in the direction that that's not what she wanted. According to WCTV News, Dwight spent about 5 years in prison for aggravated robbery, and he was released in 2003, so a couple of years before he met Allie. It's unknown if he disclosed this information to Allie, but considering what we know about her, I don't necessarily think if she was privy to this information that she'd want to move forward with a relationship with this man.
Yeah, I mean, now you've added in the fact that he has a recent history of violence.
Yes, he did get the charge when he was pretty young, but yeah, he spent 5 years in prison, and aggravated robbery is more serious than robbery, so it's not a good sign, I would say. WCTV News reported in 2022 that Dwight graduated from Florida State University with a nursing degree, and he was even granted a nursing leadership award from his program. To which I say, I would not want a potential suspect in a disappearance to be my nurse. He is innocent until proven guilty, of course, but just kind of a personal preference. I don't know. What about you?
That was kind of a shocking piece of the story you just brought up. I wasn't expecting him to be a nurse.
I know. I was shocked too. I mean, nor would I really want someone with an aggravated robbery charge treating me. I understand people can make mistakes and change their life regarding the aggravated robbery charge, but there are certain jobs that seem a little more suitable for someone with that background.
Dwight being an award-winning nurse was definitely a curveball.
Yeah, and I didn't see that one coming either. That was quite the surprise. Allie's family thinks of her every day, and sadly, during one of the many trips to Tallahassee from Riviera Beach, where her family still lived, they got into a major car accident that Allie's mom never made a complete recovery from. A tree was planted in Allie's honor on her baby's due date at Lake Ella in Tallahassee, and Allie's older sister told WCTV News, quote, "It's an acid taste not knowing. You think about it on holidays and birthdays," end quote. I can only imagine what it feels like, and I hope one day they receive answers. But for now, they hold on to their memories of Allie. The police believe they are close to solving this case, but they need just a little more evidence to wrap it all up. This case just sticks with me so much because not only do you have a grown woman who has vanished, but a grown woman who was excited to bring a baby into this world, and that never came to be. It's been 17 years since Allie disappeared. If you have any information regarding Allie Gilmore's disappearance, you are asked to contact the Tallahassee Police Department at 850-891-4462. As we always like to do with disappearances, we'd like to give you Allie's description at the time she went missing. Allie is a Black female who was 30 years old when she disappeared, and she weighed about 180 pounds and was 5'6". She'd be 47 years old today. If you'd like to see photos pertaining to this case or any other case we've covered, you can find us at Key to the Case Podcast on Instagram. Or if you'd like to reach out to us directly, you can do so at keytothecase@gmail.com. Thank you all for listening to this case today, and we will be back next Sunday with an all-new case. Bye.
Bye.